from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. In this opening hour, we want to discuss issues related to labor and unions, since, as we've seen, an uptick in the economy has led to a desire for better wages among workers, which in turn brought on strikes like the one of the BART workers' two unions. And the question is, how much have unions declined and to what extent has the strike as a tactic declined? And can unions reinvent themselves and how effective is organized labor apt to be? Those really are the questions that we want to take up in this opening hour. And let me introduce the guests who are with us for this opening hour. Harley Shaken is with us, professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies. He specializes in labor issues and is a professor at UC Berkeley. And welcome back to Forum, Harley Shaken.
Very nice to be here.
Good to have you here, and good to also have Phil Wilson, who is new to Forum, but a labor lawyer and president of the Labor Relations Institute, a management-side labor relations consulting firm. He's with us this morning. I like the sound of this, from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is actually near Tulsa. Welcome, Phil Wilson.
Thank you. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here with us. And let me begin, Harley Shaken, with you. And we're talking about really what may be somewhat of a change in terms of labor unions, and we'll talk about later on what Trumka has to say and others in the labor union movement. But the recession and globalization certainly saw a decline in the strike as a tactic, people afraid of their job loss and temporary workforce and replacement workers. Now we're seeing a kind of more, I suppose, militant rhetoric and a desire at least for maybe bringing the strike back, aren't we?
Well, we're seeing an unusual moment. We're in the midst of a modest, uncertain recovery, but that tends to give workers and unions in particular a bit of confidence to try to make up for ground loss. So we're seeing a bit of that. We're not seeing a major strike wave or even the resurgence of the strike as a labor weapon, although it remains very often the weapon of last resort. But we are clearly seeing workers concerned about getting a few gains when times, at least for right now, are a bit better.
Well, a strike would be a better weapon, presumably, in a better economy. And yet there's a kind of a generation gap here, isn't there, Professor Shaken? That is, young people are not really as aware of the strike as a tactic or for that matter, union history or union values.
Well, young people aren't as aware of unions per se. That is, people who grew up in the 50s viewed unions as a very powerful social movement. You might be for them, you might be against them, but they were a constant daily presence in your life. That's not the case today. In the 50s, about one out of three workers was a union member. Today, it's about 11%, a little over overall, and about 6.6% in the private sector. So the critical mass is much smaller today than it was several decades ago.
Well, Phil Wilson, the unions are trying to reinvent themselves, but there's been a failure to organize new workers, even though newer workers are on the horizon, or for that matter, to grow the membership, though it has at least done better here in California. One could argue a loss of political power. Organized labor, according to a New York Times recent article, is in free fall. Would you agree with that?
There's a lot of evidence for that, although I think, we're seeing evidence, as Harley mentions, of the beginnings of resurgence, perhaps. But if you want to look at the glass half empty, there's plenty of evidence for that from the number of union members is in a pretty steep decline, particularly in the private sector. I think as we move on to talk about BART, I think the public sector is an interesting place to look at union power, but certainly in the private sector, there's pretty much any way you measure it in terms of the number of members and even some of the faster-growing unions like the SEIU, who's one of the unions involved in the BART strike, the Service Employees International Union. They were one of the faster-growing unions. They have shrunk in last year's numbers. So, they are. They are certainly, by a lot of measures, on the decline. You can also, to your point on political power, the state of Michigan, is now a right-to-work state, which I think most people would, if you told them a year or two before, earlier that Michigan would be a right-to-work state, they would probably send you to, a loony bin. But it's been a tough couple of years for traditional organized labor.
Well, you've said, and I think it's an important distinction for people to realize, that organized labor or unions seem to have at least more clout in the public sector than they do in the private sector, but the big battle in Wisconsin was kind of a turning point, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Wisconsin was interesting, and I don't know that we've sort of seen the end of the fallout there. So Scott Walker, I think, you know, he was able to push through, he and the legislature there were able to push through some pretty significant reforms that certainly, you know, were opposed by the public sector unions. The unions then went after a recall movement to try to get rid of him. They failed to get rid of him. They did recall a couple of key senators, so there was at least a little bit of silver lining in those efforts. But yeah, the Wisconsin example was, and that was really sort of the first domino. There was Wisconsin. Indiana became a right-to-work state, which was also somewhat surprising. Then that followed with the with Michigan becoming a right-to-work state. So those were big challenges. And then there were some big ballot initiatives in California last year, around the same time, that also failed, that were supported by unions. So again, if you think the glass is half empty, that's the kind of stuff you'd point to.
Well, and yet, Harley Shaken, it appears as if the unions are trying to reinvent themselves. I mentioned Richard Trumko, for example, who's head of AFL-CIO, president of AFL-CIO, calling for deep thought and new organizing innovations in the union movement. And in some ways, there seems to be at least a desire to bring in maybe more non-traditional workers to do things like strikes at places where perhaps those sort of activities didn't take place in the past. There is a kind of reinvention process going on, isn't there?
Oh, I think there certainly is. Everything Phil mentioned is true. These are very tough times for labor, but historically this has tended to bring out the best in the labor movement. 1936 was a very grim year in the midst of the Depression, yet the next year the contemporary labor movement was really born in the midst of a modest recovery. I'm not saying we're that close to a resurgence here, but we are seeing a sense within the labor movement that they are in crisis. And more broadly, we're seeing a number of very innovative tactics that are showing results. For example, Unite Here, a union that represents workers in the hospitality industry and hotels, signed an agreement with the Hyatt Corporation. It was an important contract agreement for unionized workers, but far more important, Hyatt pledged to stay neutral in all the hotels it owns or operates for union organizing drives going forward. A second example of innovative strategies coming out of the AFL-CIO is Working America. This is a group that seeks to organize non-union workers who agree with labor's political principles. They've organized in the last several years about 3 million workers nationally in about a half dozen states. They plan to spread that to all 50 states. So there are signs of labor engaging what, by all accounts, are very, very tough, a very tough situation and very real obstacles that remain.
Nevertheless, last year the union movement lost 400,000 members, although it still has 14.5 million, so it's still a force to be sure. But interesting things on the horizon. For example, the number of Latino workers has increased, has it not, in union membership?
Well, absolutely. Unions have embraced immigration, and they have really worked very hard across the country to engage the Latino community, the Asian American community, other immigrant communities as well. And this has shown very, very important results. Actually, last year, if you exclude California, the labor movement lost 500,000 workers. But in California, it gained 100,000 workers. And an important dimension of that was its outreach and engagement with Latino workers.
Again, Harley Shaken is professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at UC Berkeley. And his specialization is labor issues. Phil Wilson is a labor lawyer and president of the Labor Relations Institute, which is a management side labor relations consulting firm. And what about, Phil Wilson, the calculation of when to go on strike? How to use the strike as a tactic? Has that changed over the years?
I'd like to, if I could, just follow up quickly on something that Harley was just talking about, which I do think is important. You know, I've talked about the glass being half empty, but if you're looking at the glass half full, I do think not simply just their union's embracing of immigration, but their alignment with worker centers, you know, doing a lot of the grassroots work, you know, watching what they're doing around the immigration issue is very smart on their part. Another area, and I'm sure Harley will have some thoughts about this as well, is the this alt labor movement, which is a moniker that covers a lot of different things that unions are doing. So Working America is an example of that, but they are allying with a lot of different kind of non-traditional union groups and doing some very interesting things in terms of protests. The most recent, it's called a bunch of different things, but I think the best kind of tagline is Fight for 15, but they have engaged in sort of rolling strikes across the country in retail and fast food establishments, which are traditionally areas that unions have a very tough time organizing, and a lot of people argue that it's almost impossible for them to organize because it's low wage, it's high turnover, it's transient workforce that isn't really committed to one place for very long, and so it's kind of hard to make a campaign happen there. But they nevertheless have engaged in strike activity and been reasonably, and I would say surprisingly, successful at that activity. So just as an example, they've shut down several fast food locations. They've shut down several small retail locations in cities like Chicago and St. Louis and others. And the approach is very different than the traditional, than like the BART situation. You know, it's a fight over kind of an idea versus over a particular employer and over a particular set of contract demands, and it's engaging folks in multiple different locations around the issue. And I think it ties in nicely to some of the Occupy protests that happened a couple summers ago, and I think that they're kind of carrying on that activity. So if you're looking at the glass half full, you would point to things like what Harley mentioned and some of these alt-labor activities. I think an interesting question is, okay, well, what does that mean for the traditional labor movement, and how do they, at the end of the day, their businesses themselves, I mean, they have to make money at some point. But I think, if you're looking for evidence of resurgence, that's it. And then your question was, how do they make the calculation of when to strike? And at the end of the day, my take on strikes is pretty simple. It all comes down to leverage. There's things you want. There's things that that the company wants. And if you can't get an agreement on it, then one of your weapons is to strike. And the calculation about when to do it is whether you feel like you have more leverage than the organization does, and that's exactly the calculation that occurred in the BART situation. It's the calculation that occurs in any strike.
Well, it's also certainly tactics in terms of strike with respect to timing and with respect to what kind of community support you have. And mm-hmm. Hope we can have an opportunity to talk about those some. But we should make clear the fact, Phil Wilson, that you. Your business essentially is helping businesses, so we know that you are, for the most part, one who tries to see to it, at least, as a labor lawyer, and you're very fair-minded in your presentation of the picture of unions, but it takes a side of businesses, which prompts me just to ask you, since we saw kind of an ideological shift with President Reagan and with Maggie Thatcher, why don't more businesses take the idea, especially since we've got such high unemployment rates, that we're just going to fire people and hire new workers like Reagan did with the air traffic controllers?
Well, there's a lot of there's a lot of restrictions, our laws, and I think you can if you want to talk about, I like to say they put the fun in dysfunctional, but the National Labor Relations Board that we have, whatever you want to say about them. The law is clear, and I think it's absolutely correct. You can't discriminate against somebody because they're exercising their rights to organize. And so companies are prohibited from firing people for, you know, striking or for organizing activity. There's things that companies can do to respond to those activities, and I think the balance, if you, you know, the balance in the law is pretty good. I think the problem with the law as it stands now, and I think this hurts both workers and companies, is that justice is just not very swift. It takes the agency, you know, it's like glacial speed to resolve issues, and that hurts both employers and employees. But so I think one thing that stops employers from doing that is simply it's illegal. I think even beyond that, even in fast food, even in retail, it's a highly competitive world that we live in now. And all the rhetoric aside, if you actually run a business, you can't just kind of plug in another person and away you go. You have to train people, you have to recruit them, and the people with the best talent at the end of the day win. And so just sort of having as your game plan that if somebody barks or complains about something, I'm going to fire them, it's not a very good strategy to be in business for a long time.
Of course, Harley Shaken, a lot of what we're talking about here is complicated now by just the whole question of sustainability. I mean, when you have questions of pensions and healthcare providing and so forth, as has come up in the Bart's right, as a safety for that matter, it becomes a lot more complicated.
Oh, it surely does. These are very tough issues. There are no easy answers in any of these areas. And in a way, they're all related and reflect broader public policies. But I do think we have to put it in a larger context. And here we've seen, along with the decline of unions, this isn't some abstraction or a set of statistical figures. It's also meant that workers have less leverage in the economy, and the share of our gross domestic product, that is the value of everything we produce, to labor has gone down dramatically. In 2012, salaries accounted for 43.5% of the total GDP in this country. That was a record low since they've been keeping statistics in this area. In 1969, it was 53.5%. So the decline of union strength has resulted in stagnant wages and in a lot of economic problems that translate into one of the contributing factors, very likely, to the current weakness of the recovery. 70% of our economy is consumer spending. So if consumers have less to spend, the flip side of lower wages, then we're going to see some shaky economic results down the road.
Well, that's the most, in some ways, maybe really formidable challenge to labor leaders and to unions. I mean, when Bart, for example, goes on a strike, people get angry. And we heard a lot of it on the air here the first day. Why are they asking for a wage increase when I can't get one and I haven't had one in years and all that sort of thing? There really is a kind of PR job of convincing the public that, let's say, the stake of higher wages is maybe linked. We're all in this together, that sort of thing, and the middle class and its role is perhaps at stake.
Oh, I think that's a critical challenge for unions. A moment ago, Phil mentioned that union strike and the key issue is one of leverage. I would agree with that, but today it's a bit more complicated because it isn't simply leverage across the bargaining table. Unions have realized that they must reach out and gain the support of a far broader public. And that's not incidental, particularly in a strike like BART. In the 1950s or 60s, when unions were a larger sector of the workforce, people assume, well, if the UAW wins a wage gain here, I'll be better off tomorrow because I'll be able to win it in my workplace. Today, many people view, well, if they have it and I don't mind if they lose it. And unions are seeking very hard to turn that perception around to say, if a gain is won for labor, say, in the BART situation, that is something that might translate more broadly into the rest of the economy.
Do you think this is also a generational gap? I mean, young people being more individual-minded and job security-minded and not thinking about group solidarity or anything along those lines?
Well, I think that's absolutely a part of it. But I would also point out another anomaly. We're in California, and California in so many ways leads culturally, economically, demographically for the rest of the country. In California, labor is 18% of the workforce, not 11%. And in California, we've seen labor growth, as I mentioned last year, by 100,000, while we've seen decline in the rest of the country by a half million. So the situation is a bit different politically and in terms of broader perception in California. But the underlying issue that you mentioned about younger people and about the broader consciousness and awareness of labor is a very real challenge.
Harley Shaken with us from UC Berkeley. Specialization is labor issues. And Phil Wilson, labor relations management side labor lawyer, is with us from Oklahoma. And so I was just looking at Harper's Index last night, which I enjoy reading. And the figure, for example, the number of Americans who have been hired, let's say by Apple, is pathetic. I mean, you know, it's in the low 300-something or 400-something like that. You know, outsourcing has to be figured into what we're talking about here and what is hurting the union movement and organized labor. Jobs are easy to simply ship overseas and have been.
Outsourcing is very surely a problem that labor faces, but that's mostly in the manufacturing sector. There has been outsourcing, of course, in programming and other areas that are growing, but where it had the most devastating initial impact on unions was, in fact, in manufacturing. But I think there's a broader set of issues here that Phil alluded to a bit earlier. It is very difficult to form a union in this country. You really risk companies that skirt the law or even violate the law because it's very difficult to have meaningful penalties given the current circumstances. Unions face challenges globally, but in Canada, very similar in many ways to the U.S. economy, union density, that is the percentage of workers in unions, is 28%. In Germany, it's 20%. That's the most competitive exporting economy in the world today. In the U.S., it's a little over 11%. And I think one of the factors that's different here is how difficult it is to form a union. And more broadly speaking, union leaders now, as we were speaking earlier, are well aware that it's a crisis. Some, like Rich Trumka, in fact, many union leaders have sought to portray unions as seeking to represent workers more generally and social justice across a wide swath of the economy. That means their position on immigration really stems out of that, not just self-interest or economic interest, more narrowly speaking. So you've got unions seeking to play that broader role, but it's within a climate where there's a lot of pushback and where the challenges are very real.
And Phil Wilson, let me get you on the record here. I mean, you really, I'll be frank about this, you don't believe unions do much for workers, do you?
Not really. I think that, you know, the evidence sort of speaks for itself. If unions did deliver what they promise, and you can make the argument that it's because of management doesn't want unions to get in, and I'd like to respond to something that Harley said a second ago, but or you can say that it's structural, and the economy is in such a state that unions just can't deliver. But I mean, at the end of the day, if unions actually did create these great gains for working people, union halls would look like, Walmart on the day after Thanksgiving, right? People would be banging down the doors to get in. And the fact is, it's just not true. Now, and the reason why people get upset at situations like BART is because they see folks that have a much better deal than virtually anybody else, that are, and look, rightfully so, they're doing everything that they can to keep that deal in place, and the unions are doing their job by doing everything that they can to try to keep that deal in place. But it's very hard for the average worker in America to kind of see that deal and say, more power to you. That they think that they should be happy with that deal and move on. And unions, frankly, are not getting that deal, very often. They're because of that, they're just not that, you know, they're selling a product that just isn't that attractive, and that I think is their bigger challenge, as opposed to, you know, a lot of times they'll complain that they can't organize because of the, you know, because of the law and employers that skirt the law, and you know, frankly, my whole career is based on helping educate people during these organizing events, and the bottom line is that you do not have to skirt the law. You do not have to fire people. You do not have to even get close to the boundary lines to win an organizing election, because the facts just pretty much speak for themselves. People just don't know that much about unions today. That's just the reality. They're just not that you know, common. People haven't been in them that, we're decades away from when, you know, a third of our population was in a union, and you would run into people all the time that were in one, even if you weren't. And because of that, when you get into an organizing event, the organizers who are selling the union, you know, they kind of make their pitch, and it sounds pretty good. But then when confronted with the realities of what unions actually deliver, most people say, you know, that doesn't really seem like such a great deal, and it certainly doesn't seem like something I want to pay a lot of money for.
Harley Shaken?
Well, I think there's a real core contradiction to what Phil was saying here. On one level, he's saying that people are resentment, say, of BART workers because unions have gotten them so much. And then the flip side of what he's saying is people won't join unions because they can't deliver. Both simply can't be true. I think what we're seeing is workers not joining unions very often because it's hazardous to their economic life if they do, meaning they'll get fired or they'll be disciplined in other ways, and the law isn't in place to protect them.
You've been listening to a special Labor Day edition of Forum from our archives. Our guests were Harley Shaken, professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies, specializing in labor issues, and Phil Wilson, a labor lawyer and president of the Labor Relations Institute, a management-side labor relations consulting firm. Stay with us in our second hour for more programs from our archives. I'm Michael Krasny. Happy Labor Day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.